This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
It's Monday, November 19th. Western observers have canceled their mission to monitor Russia's parliamentary elections, saying Kremlin-imposed restrictions would have made it impossible to do their work. The observers were hoping to monitor the ability of opposition groups to campaign freely. Currently, Kremlin officials say they don't understand what all the fuss is about. They got rid of opposition groups months ago. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. Last March, The Current brought you a documentary about the plight of refugees fleeing the violence in Iraq. More than 4 million people have been forced from their homes. About half of them have fled the country altogether. It is the largest mass movement in the Middle East since the creation of Israel 6 decades ago. Last February, The Current producer John Shipman traveled to Damascus, the capital of neighboring Syria, where about 1.2 million Iraqis now live. One of the people in his documentary was an Iraqi widow, and her story has become even more remarkable and troubling since that time. John Shipman is in our Toronto studio this morning for an update. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna Maria.
Now, John, remind us about the Iraqi widow who you met last winter.
Well, her name is Iman Kate, and she's a widow, as you said, and mother of two teenage twins, Mina and Raed. Her husband was assassinated in Baghdad 3 years ago. He was Sunni and she's Shia. And when I met her last February, she, like most other Iraqi refugees in Syria, was really facing very, very dire circumstances.
What was her situation?
Well, she was running out of money and she wasn't allowed to work in Syria, so she really had no way to support herself or her kids. Let's go back and listen to a little bit of my documentary again. This is from when I met Iman for the first time in her apartment.
This is our nest.
Yes.
This is our nest, my room with my children. This is our ration.
What do you have there for rations?
Rice. And noodles, yes. Sugar, where is the sugar, right? Run out. We are run out of sugar. Yes. This is the media,
you want to drink?
No, it's fine.
Why not?
No, it's fine.
You are our guest. Mushroom and tea?
Yeah,
we came here, of course, for safety. Our problem is their resettlement to me and to the other Iraqi refugees. I ask you, I beseech you, to tell your government, to tell your country, to tell the world to find solution to us. And I am an example, a symbol of many Iraqi refugees here suffering from life and difficulties.
She sounds as if she's trying to be strong in a difficult situation.
Yeah, I don't know if you could catch it in that tape, but she offered me tea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's this woman with absolutely nothing apologizing to me for not having any sugar. We finished talking after the interview, and I had said, well, that's great. And I meant the interview was great, but it kind of came out wrong.
And she thought you meant something else.
Yeah, we're standing on a concrete balcony off her tiny room, and it overlooked these demolished buildings. There were people living in tents among the rubble. I mean, Anna Maria was very grim, and she looked at me and she said, so you think my life is great, do you? And I mean, I felt horrible, but it really kind of drove home a pretty stark fact for me.
Well, you were there reporting on her life, but you didn't have to live it, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I'd gone to Damascus to cover the injustice of this kind of immense humanitarian crisis, millions of Iraqis forced from their homes and their country. But at the end of the day, I get to go back to my comfortable life in Canada, and she's still left there struggling to survive.
Mm, that's pretty uncomfortable. What did you do, John?
No, I wanted to crawl under a rock. I mean, I apologized profusely. I mean, I gave her all the money I had in my pocket at the time, which, I mean, it was only $40, and I kind of slinked back to the well-heeled hotel I was staying at.
And then, of course, you came back to Canada. You put her story on the air. Whatever happened to her?
Well, a few days after my documentary aired in March, we got an email at The Current that was passed on to me. I still have it here, Anna Maria, and I'll just read a little bit of what it said. Thank you for this morning's documentary on the plight of Iraqi refugees in Syria. My women's reading group would like to sponsor Iman and her children for immigration to Canada under the Woman at Risk program. We are prepared to assume responsibility for Iman and her children for at least 1 year or longer if necessary to make sure that they will settle successfully in Canada. And here's where you come in. Can you help us trace Iman and her children? Sincerely, and the woman's name is Heidi Bennett.
Wow, that's a pretty incredible email.
Yeah, I mean, I was floored. You end up doing a lot of stories that don't really add up to much at the end of the day. But here was one that could have a profound effect on someone's life. So I immediately contacted Heidi and put her in touch with my contact in Damascus, who put her in touch with Iman.
So who is Heidi Bennett?
She's a retired civil servant living in Victoria. But to really understand why Heidi would want to do this, and sponsoring a refugee to come to Canada is a major, major commitment. I think we really have to know a little bit more about the lives of both of these women. So the first voice you're going to hear is Heidi Bennett, and then again, Iman Kate.
I was listening as usual to The Current, and I heard the report about the situation of the Iraqi refugees, and then the interview with Iman, and that really made me pay attention.
We were living in a quarter called Saddam's Quarter near Al-Bayah with my children, of course, after Baghdad's fall. This quarter is captured by some militia. They threatened us to leave this quarter, our flat, because this militia for Shia. And my husband was Sunni, as I told you. We went to live with my sister in Al-Khadra quarter near Al-Amriya. And after that, my husband was assassinated by some terrorists. They shooted him at random. He was dead. In reality, I don't know why they shooted him. We were living in a quarter related to Sunnah. Then, also my son was kidnapped, also by terrorist people who tortured him with cigarettes and, you know, with the pistol. And to try to frighten him with the gun to scare him, but it was empty. By God's will, I can say by God's will, my son could free.
And when she described her situation and why she left, somehow it brought me back to when I was a child, because we were refugees too, and. And I thought, this is what my mother went through. I thought, that's what it must have been like for my mother. This was in Germany after the Second World War. And, you know, like millions of others, we were displaced. And we were in Germany. But when you're a refugee, and I remember this well, when you're a refugee, you're the lowest of the low. Nobody wants to have you. Nobody wants to have anything to do with you. You're just a non-person as a refugee. And, you know, I heard that in Iman's voice.
My brother-in-law came one day and suggested his proposal, that is either to accept to marry him after my husband's death or else to force my daughter, Mina, and makes her leave the school and marry to one of his sons, and also force Ra'ed to leave his school. When I refused, he began to threaten me. Unfortunately, my brother-in-law tries to plant that I and my family who killed his brother. He used to mention that to my son, Ra'ed. He used to tell him that your mother, who kills your father, because they are Shia and we are Sunni, Therefore, I decided to fled to Syria. So we got peace, and we really relieved. But I should look for a job in order to survive. I went to many offices, even to the Directorate of Education. I asked them for a job. Unfortunately, there wasn't. Raed used to ask me, how long will we stay here? And what about our future? I told them that you should not take care of that, because I'm your mother and I should manage your affairs. I told them, I can manage our affairs. And even if I can beg in order to survive you. Raed became nervous and he said he would like to return to Iraq and to die there rather to see me here and begging. I used to tell him that God is generous and I'm sure that our Lord will not leave us away.
Iman said, you know, I don't care about myself, she said. I care about my children. And she wanted to get her children out of this terrible situation. And she was trying to do whatever she could. I thought about it for a day, actually, and then I decided, if I don't do something, it'll haunt me. It'll haunt me forever.
One day in the morning, it was exactly at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was raining.
When I phoned Iman, I was very, very nervous. I introduced myself and, you know, tried to explain to her that this is a group of Canadians who want to help her come to Canada, and she didn't really know what to say, so I asked her, does she want to come to Canada? And she said she had already been to the Canadian embassy and asked if they would take her, and of course they said no. So I said, well, why do you want to come to Canada? And I never forget what she said. She said, because I want to get away as far as possible from tribal customs, tradition, and religious wars. And she said, I don't really care about myself, but for my children. I want to do this for my children. At that moment, you know, we made a commitment. The moment that I talked to Iman and offered her help to come to Canada, that was a serious commitment.
At the beginning, I can't believe it. My children, they were sleeping when they heard me talking in English. They jumped. I told them that I can't believe it. I couldn't believe that, because there is still a good people in the world. Mrs. Heidi Bennett, God blesses her.
So John, this is amazing. Heidi Bennett, a former refugee, now in Canada, tries to come to the rescue of a current refugee half a world away. What happens now?
Well, the big thing is how, you know, Iman and her children need a way to get here to Canada. So a private sponsorship, which is what Heidi wants to do, is one of four ways refugees can be resettled in Canada. Now, most refugees come to Canada first, often illegally, according even to immigration officials, and they make a claim once they're here. So the biggest hurdle for a privately sponsored claim is money. The government wants to make sure the sponsor has the financial means to support the refugee once they arrive. So you need to raise $19,300 just to make an application.
So just about $20,000.
Yeah, it's a lot of money for a private citizen, you know. I mean, Heidi's never even met Iman before, but she was undeterred. She got in touch with several friends in Victoria, and they started emailing friends and family across Canada, the United States, and Europe. And within 6 weeks, they had the money.
That didn't take long.
No. Heidi says that more than 100 people gave money, and the smallest donation was $100, and some people gave thousands. Their group is called A Village for Iman, and Heidi may have been the catalyst for all this, but it has now become a group effort. The village has found an apartment for Iman and the twins in Victoria. I mean, they even have a job offer for her from a local Save-On Foods supermarket.
So when are they coming? They're not here already, are they?
No, I'm afraid not. At first, things looked really promising. The group submitted its application to Citizenship and Immigration Canada, and I mean, it was approved within a week.
Well, that sounds fast.
Yeah, and then the application was couriered to the Canadian Embassy in Damascus, which is the Syrian capital, on June 24th of this year. Heidi really hoped that Iman and the kids would be resettled in Victoria for the start of the school year.
Well, that hasn't happened.
No, the first sign of trouble was an email the group received from the Canadian Embassy in late July. And it said Iman's application was in the queue, and they were currently processing claims made in July 2006.
2006?
Yeah, the queue was a year long at least. When Iman went back to the embassy herself, she was told it would be 2 years before they got to her application. Now, the latest estimate is next fall at the very earliest.
So how many refugees from Iraq is Canada actually accepting?
Well, Canada has committed to taking 1,400 refugees from Iraq this year, and roughly 3,000 or so have already been resettled in Canada between 2002, the year before the war started, and 2006.
That doesn't actually seem like a large number.
No, I mean, especially when you consider just how many Iraqis have been forced from their homes. I mean, we're talking about 2 million people that have fled the country altogether. That's according to the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees. And then you've got the internally displaced. The Iraqi Red Crescent says there's another 2.3 million still in Iraq. So we're talking, you know, 4.3 million people altogether, with more than a million in Syria alone.
So let's get back to Iman. How did she take this delay?
Well, as her application stalled, her personal situation in Syria also took a very serious turn for the worse. Iman's in-laws had followed her to Syria. So here's Heidi, powerless to help, watching Victoria, and Iman sees her brother-in-law one day on the street in Damascus.
When I saw him, just I saw my destiny or my fate. Run, forgot the people. Run. And turning left and right, and went through the turning in order to get rid of him, because I'm afraid, I'm scared that he can take my children.
That was one of the scariest moments. My heart just dropped. I said to Iman, okay, you have to find another place to live. You have to move out of that neighborhood. You have to move somewhere else.
Anyone who knocked at the door, we were all of us, Ra'ed, Mina, and me. We supposed that maybe they were who knocked the door and came to take them from me. So all of us trembling and tried to hide. Mina used to go to the bathroom and close the door. Ra'ed shout, who was there? And trembling, you know. I stood behind the door and shouted, who was there? Who was there? Trembling. And sometimes we just kept silent, and even we cut our breath, because we thought that maybe my brother-in-law was there.
It is extremely stressful. I mean, I wake up almost every morning thinking, you know, is she safe? Are the children safe? What can we do? The anxiety just, you know, because we never know whether she's still safe. And when we phone and she doesn't answer the phone sometimes, you know, I immediately think, oh my God, what's happened to her? Where is she? It's very, very scary.
It is just a matter of time to get me and my children. So I am so scared. As I told you, it is just a matter of time to find us. And I'm sure he will take my children from me. And that will mean commit suicide. Mm-hmm.
John Shipman, there's so much more to this story. The news is coming up, but you will come back in our second half hour to tell us more of what has happened to Iman and her children.
I will, Anna Maria.
John Shipman is a producer with The Current. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current. John, just before the news, we heard how Iman Kate discovered her brother-in-law was looking for her and the children in Damascus, eager essentially to haul them back to Baghdad. What are Heidi Bennett and the rest of her sponsorship group in Canada doing for her at this point then?
Well, I mean, they immediately told Iman that she's got to get out of her apartment. She's got to move into another part of the city. And they paid, once she found a new apartment, they paid the rent for her for 6 months in advance. Now, the group has also been trying to get Iman declared a quote-unquote woman at risk that, I mean, it really should theoretically expedite her case. This is a classification with the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, and it's meant for female widows who have extraordinary protection needs.
So would she qualify?
She would seem to, but she's having a really hard time getting the classification. Just last month, she went for an interview at the UNHCR office in Damascus. Now, Iman says the official there was Sunni, and most Syrians are, and Iman felt the woman was very dismissive of her conditions.
Why?
Well, Iman got the feeling it was because of her religion. Now, remember, Iman is Shia, a fact that she was asked about repeatedly during this interview.
So she thinks her need for protection was being dismissed by this official because of her religion?
Exactly. Heidi and her group complained, and I also contacted the UNHCR, and just yesterday, actually, Iman was interviewed again, and this time, apparently, it went much better.
Well, that's a little promising. Now, what about the Canadian embassy in Damascus? Any help there?
Well, the Canadian embassy has not been very helpful. Officials there sound pretty disorganized, actually. Heidi and Iman say they've had to send 4 copies of the same application because they keep getting misplaced.
Why is that happening?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. One of the reasons could be simply a lack of resources to process all these refugee claims. But, I mean, it is troubling regardless.
Now, what are Iman's chances of being allowed to come here once her application is finally processed?
Well, an Amnesty International report last month criticized the Canadian Embassy in Damascus for refusing 70% of privately sponsored refugee applications. I mean, this means that Iman could wait up to 2 years to have her case processed. And even then, she still has less than a 1 in 3 chance of actually having it approved.
So if there's a 70% rejection rate, are there any other options?
Well, there are. I mean, Ottawa could make a special commitment to bring in more Iraqi refugees. They've done it before for other groups. In fact, my in-laws are among 11,000 refugees who came from Czechoslovakia in the late 60s. Canada did it again in 79 and 80 when they resettled more than 60,000 boat people from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Mm. And they also did it in 99 when they resettled 7,000 Kosovars. So, I mean, there is a precedent for it.
And is there any sign of a similar effort for Iraqis?
Nothing as of yet. Now, as for Iman's case, Heidi has stumbled on another option as well, and I'll let her explain.
I was in Europe in the summer, and I came back through this very busy European airport. And the flight was totally booked out, so there was pandemonium at the gate. And ahead of me was a Nigerian couple. There were three, a man and a woman, and another gentleman in a suit. And they were eventually allowed to proceed to the waiting lounge. And, you know, having done immigration in Warsaw, I was a little bit suspicious and also curious what was going on there. This gentleman in the suit pulled them aside, gave them a briefing. They got on the plane. He sat in the front. They sat way in the back. When we got off, he again gave them a briefing, and then he didn't talk to them anymore. And I'm quite sure that when they got to the customs and immigration counter, they made a refugee claim. To me, it was so obvious. And it looked so easy. If I had to do it again, knowing what I know now, and, you know, I have to tell you, I've been a law-abiding citizen all my life. I've never even had a speeding ticket. But if I had to do it again, I would give Iman the money and I would tell her, go buy forged documents, come to Canada, make a refugee claim as soon as you get here, and then everything will be looked after. That's by far the easiest way.
Wow, is she serious? About just giving Iman money and letting her fly her with, what, a fake passport?
Well, I mean, as she says, if she had to do it over again, but I think in this case, it really speaks more to the frustration that she and everyone else is feeling. I mean, you can understand why. If Iman was able to get herself and her kids into Canada, she'd be safe from her in-laws, first and foremost, but also while she's waiting for her claim to be processed, she'd have access to emergency health care, although not full Medicare. She'd be able to get a temporary work permit so she could support herself, and she'd have access to legal aid in British Columbia as her claim is being processed. Plus, the final decision on her claim would be made by the Immigration and Refugee Board here in Canada rather than a visa officer in Damascus.
And are the chances of being able to stay in Canada any better if someone's applying from within the country?
Well, last year, 16,000 claims were approved for refugees that came from within Canada. Now, you compare that to the privately sponsored applications from abroad, and this is not just Iraqis, but all refugees, and that number is just over 3,300. So you really start to understand the incentive for refugees to come here illegally.
But that can't be easy.
No, it isn't at all. Refugees pay thousands. I mean, some pay tens of thousands of dollars to get into Europe, North America, Australia. I mean, it can involve complicated routes, flying around the world several times, literally. A refugee from the Middle East may sit in a hotel in Singapore for 2 weeks waiting for someone to take them on their next leg into Canada or the United States, wherever they're going. And often they don't even know where they're going. A refugee may be hoping he'll land in Canada and end up in Australia. In the first 9 months of 2007, less than 200 Iraqis applied for refugee status from within Canada. So, yes, it's clearly very difficult for them to get here illegally.
And that's not surprising. There must be a really high level of security, I guess, after 9/11.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Canada now spends a lot of time and money trying to catch people traveling on forged documents. Canada's Border Service Agency has dozens of officials. I mean, they call them migration integrity officers, and they're farmed out all around the world trying to catch smugglers and traffickers, which makes perfect sense. But legitimate refugees fleeing persecution and violence, they end up getting caught in the same net.
Well, what about Heidi Bennett? Could she get in trouble if she decided to help Iman and the children come here illegally?
Well, again, Heidi may be frustrated, but I have to stress that she hasn't actually done anything in that regard. And yeah, it is a good thing because according to Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, it is an offence to knowingly organise, induce, aid, or abet anyone coming into Canada illegally.
And would that even apply to someone who was acting on what they considered to be humanitarian grounds?
Yeah, take the case of Janet Hinshaw Thomas. She works with a humanitarian group in Pennsylvania. And in the past 5 months, the group has made 19 trips to the Canadian border to help refugees make claims. And it contacts Canadian border security ahead of time, every time, to let them know they're coming. But Ms. Hinshaw Thomas was charged in September after one such trip with a group of Haitians. And the maximum sentence that she was facing, life in prison.
I remember this case, but now weren't these charges dropped?
Yeah, they were, but only after a lot of immediate attention. The Canadian Council for Refugees says the law is so vague that it could be applied to anyone, regardless of their motivations. I mean, even family members.
Really? Okay. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, say you're from Afghanistan and you've resettled here and now have Canadian citizenship, but your sister back home is facing imminent danger and her refugee claim is stalled to come to Canada. So you're desperate to get her out. You mail her your passport, tell her to travel here, whatever, just come to Canada, get out of your situation. But if she's caught, you could be charged with people smuggling.
And what about the refugee in that case?
Well, she could be charged too, which would throw her legitimate claim into jeopardy.
So where does this all leave Iman Kate and Heidi Bennett?
Well, it leaves Iman and her children stuck in Damascus, hiding, literally, from her in-laws. And it leaves Heidi and the rest of the sponsorship group really powerless in Victoria. I mean, they're completely frustrated with the bureaucracy, but they're really unable to help in any other way.
You feel so helpless because there are things happening in Syria over which we have no control. It just adds to the anxiety, and all we can do at this end is just keep trying to bring this to the attention of the Minister for Immigration and keep trying to convince the embassy that this is an urgent case and that, you know, they keep trying to get them to even pay attention. I mean, you have to keep going. You can't just say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do.
And I really believe that there are good people in the world. I got hope. I got dream to go to Canada and live peacefully with my children without those in-laws. I just want to live with my children.
Hmm. Well, John, Heidi mentioned the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, Diane Finley. We have her waiting in the wings to address some of these issues. Thank you for this report, John Chipman.
Thank you very much, Anna Maria.
John Chipman is a producer with The Current. He was in our Toronto studio this morning. He originally gathered some of that tape in Damascus last winter and then, again, brought us an update about Iman Kate and Heidi Bennett. Well, as I said, Diane Finley, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, is with us in Ottawa to address some of the issues that this case raises. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to clarify, first of all, are you able to speak about Imam Kate's specific case?
Unfortunately, for privacy reasons, I can't address the specifics of any case.
Okay, well,
talk in general terms, though.
Okay, and you have been listening this morning as we talked about her plight and Heidi Bennett's efforts to help. Do you have any comments on this kind of effort?
Well, you know, it's very unfortunate with the situation in Iraq and the humanitarian crisis that's going on there. There are some close to 3 million Iraqis who are displaced now. And Canada has been working with the UN, with the UNHCR, to resettle as many of them as possible. The UN prefers to settle people as close to their home country as possible, but Canada has, we've increased our targets for this year to 1,400 Iraqis that we're hoping to resettle here.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you do work with the UN, do you? So if the UNHCR interviews a refugee and then classifies someone as at risk, does that accelerate any part of the process for the Canadian government in looking at who to allow into the country?
Most definitely, although they are still subject to our security and medical checks because their first job is to protect the health and safety of those who are already here.
Mm-hmm. But then again, technically, if someone has that classification, they should go a little faster.
Oh, yes, most definitely. But one thing we've also done is with our office in Damascus, we have opened up the family class for Iraqi refugees, whether they're Iraqi applicants, whether they're located in Iraq or in one of the neighboring countries, to put a priority processing on them if they're sponsored by someone here in Canada.
Okay, tell us how that would work then. Is someone who is related to them here?
Yes. Well, already we have dependents and spouses and children, but this would extend to parents and such, parents and grandparents, so that we make a priority of bringing them over as well.
Okay, and your department has done this very recently, has it?
Yes, we have.
And
we're putting priority processing on those individuals. So I encourage anyone who is in the process of sponsoring an Iraqi to come here, whether they're a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident already, to make sure they get in touch with Immigration Canada to make sure they're on that priority list.
Now, would this help someone like Iman who is being privately sponsored by people who are unrelated to her?
Well, the priority right now is on family reunification. We want to get those people who have close relatives in Canada reunited with them here.
Mm-hmm. And does that actually, you've got numbers, you want to make that happen. Does it also fast track then some of those refugees who are related? It would take them less time to get here than it would normally take then?
Well, a UN-designated refugee obviously moves, gets a priority assessment, but family members under this expansion that we've just launched would also get priority processing.
Okay. So now let me ask you, the latest information from the Canadian Embassy in Damascus is that it will be next fall at the earliest before the case of Iman Kate is reviewed. In general, is a year-long wait the norm, and is that acceptable to you as minister?
Well, we've been very frustrated since we took government to realize the level of backlogs that exist in all categories. Part of that is because Canada is such a popular place to come to. I mean, we have a great country here, and it's a land of hope for many. But the frustration is that these, you know, just a few years ago, for example, in the permanent residence class, there were only 50,000 people who were in the backlog. We were accepting about 200,000 a year. Our government's taken it up to around 250,000 a year, but the previous government allowed the backlog to balloon from 50,000 to 800,000 people. And that's not something that was created overnight, and we're not going to be able to fix it overnight, but we are definitely taking steps to work through it, to find alternatives, because we want Canada to be a destination country for people who have the talents and skills that we need. And a backlog like that is just going to put them off from coming here. It's not acceptable to us by any way, and we are taking steps to deal with it.
Have you increased the numbers of staff in places then, like Damascus?
What we've been doing is reorganizing our systems to make them more efficient and putting priority on those cases, such as the Iraqi refugees and Iraqi applicants who are in most need.
Now, in October, Amnesty International criticized Canada because the embassy in Damascus rejects 70% of privately sponsored applications. Can you tell us why that is?
Well, we have different acceptance rates around the world, and they vary significantly because of the fraud rates that are prevalent in some areas, because of the security risks in many cases. Some countries, there are people who have been involved in military conflicts directly who are deemed inadmissible. Some people don't pass the criminality checks. Some people don't pass the medical tests. And we have to maintain our number one priority as being the safety and security of people who are already here in Canada.
Well, I want to ask about that, the criminality checks. We are talking about Iraq, where there is a war on and there is an insurgency, and you arguably don't know who everyone is who's crossed the border into Syria looking to go to another country. How do you prioritize, and does a widow with two children fit a different priority anyway?
Well, each case is reviewed on its own merits. We do extensive background checks to determine whether the applicant is telling the truth in their application, to verify any information that's provided to us, because some people are so desperate to get here that, and you've heard it, that they're willing to go to illegal processes to do it, and that's not acceptable.
I was wondering what you thought, actually, as you listened to Heidi Bennett describing what she had seen and the temptation of the illegal route. What did you think as you heard that?
Well, obviously, people are very frustrated. We're frustrated as well at our ability to get people here as quickly as possible. We're doing what we can to improve that. We're working with the UN. I met with the Canadian representative, Erica Felker, just last week to discuss this issue and see how we can work together to make sure that their needs are met as well as ours and the needs of these people who are living in these humanitarian crises.
Mm.
And so while we're working towards it, there is no simple overnight fix, unfortunately. We're trying, we're doing our best, and setting priorities where they need to be to make sure, in this case, family reunification takes place, that family members aren't stranded across the world, but wherever possible, if there's someone who in Iraq or who's fleeing Iraq, if they have a close family relationship here in Canada, let's get those people back together as quickly as possible.
How concerned and frustrated are you then by those people who look at this and say it's just easier to do it illegally and go through the system that way?
Well,
are you worried that it encourages this?
Well, this is one of the fears that I have, yes, because the backlogs do encourage that. They also discourage legitimate people from coming, people with a lot of talent to contribute to our economy. None of this works for Canada as well as it should, and that's why we're taking steps to improve it. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do it overnight, but we have instituted a number of new programs to accelerate the process for people who really need and deserve it.
Mm.
Because after all, I mean, Canadians want a refugee system that helps and protects legitimate refugees.
Now, if a refugee is caught coming here illegally, is that person still allowed to make a claim?
Again, each case is measured on its own merits. Some people do have to for security reasons, but the legitimacy of their claim is then scrutinized very closely because, unfortunately, a lot of people who are merely economic refugees, they can't make a living where they are, try to come to Canada and abuse our system. And so we have to be very vigilant against those people.
Now,
because they're blocked, not only are they coming, applying inappropriately, but they're clogging up the system for the legitimate refugees, the ones we want to help.
And, you know, we heard the case of the U.S. aid worker, Janet Hinshaw Thomas, who had charges against her dropped earlier this year. Do you think people should be prosecuted for smuggling refugees into Canada, even if they are legitimate refugees and these are humanitarian reasons?
Well, human trafficking is a worldwide problem, and we're taking steps to deal with that. We've been at, I tabled legislation in the House last spring. We'll be retabling it this fall to deal with that. And it's very, very difficult for border officers to determine what is legitimate and what is not, which are the real ones, which are not, because the human trafficking problem is so pervasive around the world, and it's very sophisticated. So each refugee claim has to be evaluated on its own unique merits and circumstances.
So what advice would you as minister give to an organization like the one that Heidi Bennett started to bring a specific person who they heard about, they raise the money, they're willing to take responsibility for someone, and part of that is a very onerous task, of course, and it's the whole financial hurdle. What advice would you give to people who want to do that and then get caught up in the red tape of waiting?
Well, private sponsorship is a very noble effort. I applaud people who do that because they are taking on a very big responsibility for a number of years. And we encourage that because it does help the newcomers succeed in Canada. That being said, there are legitimate routes to take. As I say, in our Damascus office is putting a priority processing on reuniting family members here. Those people who are sponsors who are involved with such cases need to get in touch with our office to make sure they're on the priority list. Other than that, we work through the work very closely with the UNHCR, and contact with them is often very helpful.
Now, I know that you made the point that you are accelerating family reunification specifically for Iraqis caught up in the war. But do you have plans to do what Canada has done before, like it did with Kosovars, like it did with the Vietnamese and the Laotians and Cambodians earlier, where more people, even if they don't have relatives here, were brought in?
Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of those things all around the world.
So do you plan to do that with Iraqis?
Well, at the moment, we're working with the Karen refugees, because unfortunately there are a lot of people around
that's
the world
in Burma.
The spotlight may not be on them, but they may have been in refugee camps for 7, 10, 12, 17 years. And we just announced that we're bringing in another, I think it's 5,000 Bhutanese refugees. We're working with the Karens. We welcomed them, the first round of Karen refugees in London, Ontario, and they're doing very well, and they're just so appreciative, and we're expanding that program as well. We have to remember that there are people in many parts of the world living in totally intolerable conditions in refugee camps. The spotlight just is not always on them, and we're trying to help as many of these as possible right around the world.
Diane Finley, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today.
You're quite welcome, Anna Maria.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Diane Finley is the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration. She spoke to us from Ottawa. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.